Welcome to the Women in Sport and Exercise Academic Network podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jackie Forsyth, and also co-founder of the network. The purpose of the Women in Sport and Exercise Academic Network is to grow, strengthen, and promote research on women in sport and exercise, with the ultimate goal of optimising women's athletic success and their participation. With these podcasts, we wish to bring you information from leading academics who are researching about women in sport and exercise and provide you with advice and support for the exercising female. Please remember our disclaimer that the opinions, content and recommendations contained within our podcast are for general information only and should not be substituted for medical advice, treatment or diagnosis. This podcast is with Dr. Nikki Kay, who studied medicine at Cambridge University, which also included clinical attachments at sports medicine clinics in Australia and at the University of Geneva. After gaining membership of the Royal College of Physicians, Nikki trained in endocrinology. As a research fellow at St. Thomas's Hospital, she was part of an international medical team which developed an anti-doping test for growth hormone. With sport medicine grants, Nikki researched and published about the training effects on the endocrine system. She has published more recently on relative energy deficiency in sports, or RED-S, and wrote the British Association of Sport and Exercise Medicine educational website, Health for Performance, on RED-S. Nikki is also the medical advisor to Scottish Ballet, part of a multidisciplinary team at Enspire Clinic for dancers and athletes, and is Chief Medical Officer of Fourth Edge, which provides medical interpretation of blood tests to athletes. Nikki is currently an Honorary Fellow at Durham University, researching the risk of RED-S in dancers and athletes. I asked Nikki about the energy availability questionnaire that she has developed, her personal experiences and thoughts on reversibility and treatment for amenorrhea, her current research and her future plans. So Nikki, great to have you doing this podcast. Welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So if you don't mind, I just thought I'd start talking about detection of energy availability, because I know you've done this study where you've used an energy availability questionnaire for male cyclists, and you're also in the process of validating an energy availability questionnaire for ballet dancers with the Scottish Ballet, I think. Are there some issues particularly you found with this in detecting energy availability?
The reason I'm developing these questionnaires is because if we want to do it absolutely by the book, and the exact definition of energy availability is how much energy there is available once you've taken into account how much the person is putting in the system, how much they're expending on their exercise, what's the residual energy, what is energy availability. So we could measure that in the lab and record diaries work out how much energy the athletes expended exercising. But realistically, it's not possible or practical, as Louise Burke outlined in an excellent paper, saying that in the real world, in athletes in the field, you know, it's not practical to do that. And also, in order to work that out, you would also need to do a DEXA scan to work out the lean mass. So we cannot do that apart from in the study situation. So that was the point of me developing these questionnaires, to identify those at risk and home it down into those where we do need to do some blood tests and look at bone health. So that was the point of the questionnaire, a screening questionnaire. So there is already in existence the LEAF Q, which is the low energy availability for female athletes, which is all very well and good, but it's not specific to the sport or activity, dancing, for example. And also the other thing is it's only inclusive for half the population, i.e. nothing for males. So that's why I think, and that's why I'm doing this research at the minute, to develop sport-specific questionnaires, number one, and also to bear in mind that we have to include men. So there would be an option in these questionnaires. If you're a man, then you get diverted off down that track. But if you're a woman, then of course you're going to be asking the detailed questions about menstrual cycles. So that's really, in essence, the rationale for developing these sports-specific questionnaires. Because in my experience, athletes, they want to be identified as individuals. A cyclist would be not take kindly to you calling them a dancer and vice versa. So you have to, and also to get really decent responses, if you will, then starting off the questionnaire, which I try to do, is always about their sport. How much training are they doing? Because they want to talk about that sort of thing. So to get more of an idea of how much training they're doing. So that's, in a nutshell, why I'm doing that.
So in that case, it's the questionnaire. Is it just a matter of language? So then you just change dancer to cyclist, or am I oversimplifying this?
Yes, to a certain extent, for sure. The first bit of the questionnaire, I ask about their training history. So when did you start cycling, dancing? What type of dance or cycling are you doing? So, you know, there's ballet, there's modern, there's hip hop, there's all sorts, and same for cycling. You ask them, are they a time trialist? Are they a road cyclist? The finer details, and if it was football, what position do you play? What's your training load? And break it down into the types of training, how many hours of endurance, how many hours of strength and conditioning, whatever. So the first bit is definitely really, really specific to the sport, because you need that information anyway. And then I have to be honest, yes, to some extent, the other questions about injuries, both fractures and soft tissue, you are asking the same question, but you've got to just give that little flavour that you're talking. So the athlete feels involved and you're talking to them specifically. You're more likely to get you're more likely to get them to answer all the questions. So you're right. Why am I bothering to do that? Because you're more likely to get accurate answers. And there are big differences in sport between the type and amount of training, because the type of training that dancers do is obviously totally different to all the aerobic endurance training that a cyclist would do. So actually, it is important actually as well to quantify that.
I've just realised I've jumped straight into asking you a really specific question on energy availability. So maybe if I could go back, if you don't mind, because I think one of your drives for studying Red S and the female athlete triad was because of personal experience. Do you mind me talking about this?
No, sure. I mean, it's a long time ago now, so.
Yeah, but I think I read that you didn't have a period until you were 32 years of age. And then I think you've also done something on reversibility. So have you got any research or any applied experience of whether these athletes or individuals who've not menstruated, for instance, mm-hmm. or have had symptoms associated with female athlete triad, specifically females, how have they been able to reverse their particular symptoms, or to what extent have they been able to do that?
Well, I mean, yeah, just on my personal experience, yeah, I mean, I'm very old, so so when I had, nowadays, I was a barn door Reds female athlete triad, because I had primary amenorrhea. My periods definitely had not started by the time I was 16, as you say, not until I was the grand age of 32. Anyway, so, but at that point, there was no, even female athlete triad, it was a bit hazy. And also, I didn't look ill. That's the other thing. And that's the thing about Reds and female athlete triad. And by the way, just for simplicity, I know those who are strong advocates of the female athlete triad think, you know, don't totally agree with Reds. But in my opinion, so we don't keep repeating ourselves, when I say Reds, I'm including the female athlete triad. So back then, it was very, very hazy what was going on. And to all intents and purposes, I looked fine. I was just a slim person doing a lot of ballet, and that was it. And that's today still the case. That, you know, lots of these athletes who are in low energy availability, they do not look like they've got a rip-roaring eating disorder. They will be slim, undoubtedly. But then if you scratch below the surface, you find actually they are following restrictive eating patterns, maybe not a full-blown eating disorder. And they're addicted to their training and all sorts of things. So that's really my personal experience of that, realizing that me, a medical doctor, could go around walking you know, with no periods in my 20s, and everyone was saying, oh, there's nothing wrong. It's like, hold on a second. There must be something, you know, anyway. So that was my motivation really for getting into this, because I know exactly. I also know exactly, I can read someone's mind. It's like, I know what you're thinking right now. To a certain extent, you know, I understand the motivations for why you might end up in this situation. So that's where I'm coming from. And the other thing that really focused my attention, moving on to the reversibility element of it, I mean, me personally, I'm actually very, very fortunate. I didn't get a stress fracture. I have no idea how, because I was doing impact stuff. I was dancing. And I know for a fact that my bone density was horrendous. I was a fortunate one that I didn't get stress fracture. And I was also fortunate that eventually I realized there was something more important than life when I had my children. It's like, actually, you know, I need to get my act together and whatever. Anyway, so and my periods came back and, you know, everything ended up pretty well for me. But nevertheless, I know that there are situations. I did a study with retired female, professional female dancers several years ago now, premenopausal dancers. And I was really, well, yes, it was quite a shocking finding written up in the BJSIM, British Journal of Sports and Exercise Medicine, that those dancers, even though they'd stopped dancing professionally and their periods had resumed, if they have a history of delayed menarche and or, this was the worst combination, long periods of secondary amenorrhea, then their lumbar spine, the Z score for their lumbar spine age match, was still significantly below what you would expect for someone that was doing a weight-bearing activity. That's the thing. So from that study, I was concerned there didn't seem to be a lot of evidence for reversibility. But on the other hand, there are people like me and there are other individual cases where actually everything has come good, if you will. So I think really what we're saying is it is a very individual thing. Of course, bone density, for a start, is about 70% genetically determined. So even now, I'm seeing quite a lot of athletes who give me their clinical history, and I would think, oh gosh, they're going to have dreadful bone density, and lo and behold, they don't, or vice versa. Someone actually who didn't seem to have such a significant clinical history, and then you do the DEXA, and it's really quite concerningly low. So I think really what we're seeing in terms of reversibility, whether why there's this question mark, is because it depends where you're starting from and also your genetic determinants in the first place. So that, I think, why there's not a clear-cut answer to you about reversibility. Oh, definitely, if you've been amenorrheic for X amount of time, then yes, your bone density, whatever. We know that certainly there is potential for reversibility. In the recent study of my R male cyclists, they improved their bone density over just 6 months. Conversely, those that didn't follow the suggestions or went off and reduced their energy intake, they lost bone mineral density over just 6 months. So certainly there is potential either way for deterioration and improvement, but I think to some extent it depends on the individual, and that's why we haven't got a clear-cut answer to that.
And regarding treatment of amenorrhea, because I read in one of your blogs you were recommending HRT over oral contraceptive pill, and you gave some rationale for that. Could you just explain that?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, if it's functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, as the name suggests, it's functional. It's dependent on behaviours. So it's not a medical cause of amenorrhea. So, but if you have got someone who has got functional FHA, functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, then of course the most important thing is to try and look at their behaviors, try and discuss the food intake, and maybe suggest reducing the intensity of their training load in order to restore energy availability and they get their own menstrual cycles back. That is of course always the priority. However, what do you do if this person is going to, you can see it's going to be a real struggle psychologically for them to make those changes, and you haven't got time on your side? They've already got a Z score of less than minus one in the lumbar spine, and or they've got two or more stress fractures. So you've got a really high risk person and you haven't got time on your side whilst you try and implement the changes that they need to do. So in that situation, that's the sort of woman we're talking about. What are you going to do to protect their bones in the short term? And there's very good evidence. My colleague, Dr. Kate Ackerman from the States, she did a study looking at this, and she found that the combined oral contraceptive pill was not bone protective, whereas HRT did protect the bones. And also specifically the route of HRT administration, it was transdermal for estrogen. So that could either be a patch or a gel. And that the progesterone component, that's a little bit more tricky. It's not so well absorbed by the skin. There is a patch for progesterone, or I tend to prefer microionized progesterone. It is an oral tablet, but at least it's identical in the molecular considerations. And you have to say that in a cyclical form, the progesterone component, so the person would get withdrawal bleeds. But to stress, this is only in selected situations where they need bone protection, and it's obviously not a long-term thing. So the maximum I would say to the athlete, well, basically I sort of have a deal with the athlete. I say, first of all, I would advise this, but please, it's not a get out of jail card. It's just a temporary measure. So whilst you try and affect the changes we've discussed, so that's kind of like the deal. The other deal is that, so that they're aware, this is just for a maximum of 6 months. And also, of course, it's not a contraception. So please use barrier methods of contraception. So you have to sort of give all those explanations around it. And the other thing that often I get asked is then the person has read stuff in the press, oh, HRT increases risk of breast cancer, blah, blah, blah. But it's replacement. We're just replacing the levels, which is actually another advantage of HRT versus the oral contraceptive pill, because oral contraceptive pill, they're supraphysiological doses. And if you take the oral contraceptive pill, your blood test will look exactly the same as if you have functional hypothalamic amenorrhea. So in other words, you're just reinforcing what you're trying to correct, if you will. So that's why, frankly, it's not useful. Whereas HRT is just replacing it to a normal level. So we don't have that concern. And anyway, it's only for a short term.
And as a medical doctor, and I know you can't speak for all medical doctors in the UK, but do you think that message is getting across? Because you're obviously very knowledgeable in this particular area, but you must see people getting treated with oral contraceptives for amenorrhea from GPs who are not as knowledgeable as you. So how are you trying to get that message out there?
Yes, well, you make a very good point. And again, no disrespect to my professional colleagues, but, you know, in a general medical practice, of course, they're not going to know these finer details. And there are a lot of ill people, although we say National Health Service, actually, it's probably more the National Sickness Service. So it's someone, like we said, who's got reds, looks ostensibly totally fine. And the GP will be delighted that they're exercising compared to lots of the patients they're seeing. But it is a misconception. And of course, I'm trying to get that message across. I wrote the website for BASEM, British Association of Sports and Exercise Medicine, called Health for Performance. So anyone, you know, needing more information, and there's a healthcare section. So many of the athletes I see, if people are trying to bung them on the oral contraceptive pill, I say, well, look, just take along the page and show it to your GP. And so that the GP is aware that this is happening. So, I mean, that's really the, yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. But I think the thing about the oral contraceptive pill, it makes everyone feel better. You see, you give someone that and now, oh, they're having bleeds. But of course, those aren't your real periods. They're withdrawal bleeds. But nevertheless, the misconception is, oh, well, I'm taking some hormones. I'm getting a bleed. Everyone feels better psychologically. The GP, the athlete, the coach, you know, but actually it's not doing what you need it to, what you want to achieve. I'm doing my best. I get the message out there, and any conferences and podcasts, I'm always saying exactly this. So, you know, little by little, but also educating the athletes and the dancers so that they are discerning athletes and dancers, and, you know, to ask questions and if necessary, show the website. And then that hopefully will make things a little bit easier for them as well.
This is not just about GPs and medical professionals, but it's all sort of professionals or people that are dealing with women specifically. You mentioned in one of your blogs how women are under-researched. And I really like the example that you gave of somebody who had a myocardial infarction, heart attack, and the symptoms potentially could be different for females than males.
Yeah. So Yeah, I wrote a blog about that called Of Mice and Men, which I was quite pleased with the title. And it had an illustration of a mouse with a testosterone molecule in him, because it goes back just even in the lab. They're using male cells, male mice, male clinical trials. And then we wonder why we don't know what's going on with the female. I mean, the reason why females have been avoided, if I can put it that way, because, you know, because the hormones are complex. And so it really puts it does make it tricky, but that should be something we should be embracing as scientists and doctors. It's like, that's a challenge, isn't it? And anyway, they're half the population. But yeah, going back to the heart attack question, is that myocardial infarction, and I was taught this at medical school as well, central crushing, chest pain, etc. But guess what? And women are called atypical presentation. But the point is, they're atypical for a man, but it's typical for a woman. So, you know, thank goodness that's now being recognized. Women do present, of course, they're going to express, they have a slightly different, so the men it is the central crossing chest pain, and women it could be more of an indigestion thing. And also, I would just cheekily like to argue that women are more stoical, so, you know, central crossing chest pain for them is just like, oh well, listen, it's a little bit uncomfortable, I'll just get on with it. But that's a slightly cheeky aside. So in clinical settings, it is a bit scary if you look at clinical textbooks, which I went to do, and you look, where is this information come from? Yes, it is mainly based on men. I think also in drug trials, of course, on the one hand, you know, with all the thalidomide issue, etc., there is a hesitancy. We don't know what the outcomes are of certain drugs in women. But then you could argue that that's even more important to find out before you put something on the market like that. Anyway, so that's another side of it that is an issue. But hopefully now we're talking about this and it is recognized that this is an issue, and hopefully that will see more progress in the future.
And Nikki, what are your next steps, or what are your current steps for research at the moment? Because I think I saw something about a particular piece of equipment for measuring bone strength. So radio frequency echographic multispectrometry, is that right?
Yeah. That's right. Let's just call it REMS.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
That's
so
better.
Yeah. It's a specialist type of ultrasound. I mean, at the moment, of course, the gold standard is DEXA. There's no question about that. But there are some downsides to DEXA, even though it's very low dose ionizing radiation. Nevertheless, it is ionizing radiation. And also, therefore, it's very difficult, or unless you're doing it in a study, and even then, to do it any more frequently than every year. But as we've discussed, bones potentially can change more quickly than that. So that's the advantage of using REMS, that it's ultrasound, so it's not ionizing radiation. And it's also, it's portable, so you can take it to dance companies, sporting bodies or whatever. And in addition to measuring the usual BMD, bone mineral density, they've developed an extra modality that gives you this fragility score. So again, normally, currently, the only way of assessing bone microarchitecture is by CT. Peripheral, and CT is really high radiation, and therefore that's, you can only do it peripherally, because you can't be justifying doing a CT of the abdomen just to measure the microarchitecture of the bone. It's, you know, the question is it reflective actually of what, and the lumbar spine frankly is what we really want to know, or more precisely we'll want to know the differential between, in REDS terms I mean, the differential between the lumbar spine and the femoral neck, because the lumbar spine is trabecular bone and the femoral neck is cortical. So that's really where the crucial bit of information. And so that's why REMS is potentially very useful. And we've recently purchased one for Durham University, so with my colleague, Dr. Karen Hind. So that has been a really useful tool for me in my research. So when I'm doing these questionnaires I've been discussing to assess energy availability, then matching it up with blood tests is key. And also, you know, I think that maybe REMS could be a useful tool for this, and especially for monitoring change, because you can do it more frequently. I mean, of course, there are those that say, oh, well, you know, how does it match up with DEXA? Is it the gold standard? And But even within different DEXA machines, there's a correction factor between the type of machine you're using, whether it's a Hologic or Lunar. And the point is, REMS is a bit, in my mind, a bit like the impedance measurement. Yes, there are lots of issues with the impedance. It's not super accurate, et cetera, but guess what? It is really useful for an individual to do it, to monitor change. And that's, I think, where this REMS may come into its own, more as a sort of a monitoring tool. So you've got a reference point for that individual. Are they going up, down? What's happening? So, yeah, that's an exciting area, I think, to explore.
What then would you think that you want to achieve in your career, sort of finally, if you ever get to retire? Because I see that you're really, really busy. But if you ever hang up your ballet slippers, you know, just chill a little bit. What will you look back and go, right, I'm really glad that I've achieved this, especially for females?
Well, I mean, so far, I guess, first of all, I'm pretty pleased, you know, feel I've made some useful contributions so far. So that's great. As we discussed with the dancers, especially getting the dancers under the spotlight, I think would be something, because at the moment it's been very much athletes and especially runners. I've got nothing against runners, but it's not my personal thing. And also there are lots of other sports and activities. So I think, reflecting that I have brought discussing dancers into the equation, that's I feel proud of that, and hopefully, as you say, going to do some more with that. And I'm hoping also that this initiation with the sports specific questionnaires, this would hopefully be a really valuable area, not just for professional athletes, by the way, because even the aspiring amateur, I would argue, is more at risk of issues. Female cyclists, for example, they don't have so much the spotlight, and of course football, female football. So getting more research for the female athletes, but and not necessarily the professionals, but the aspiring amateurs, and also just the keen gym goers, because I've seen quite a few of those women who are going assiduously to do their HIIT training session fasted in the morning, and then actually, it turns out they have effectively got REDS because they're doing faster training, and they're not, they've been told or they've heard that, oh, I shouldn't eat so many carbohydrates, and actually they've also got REDS. So I think that is really opening up the discussion for women, all levels of exercise, any type of exercise, sport, dancing. So that's hopefully when I retire, I will be able to reflect, oh, yes, I made that I made the change there.
Well, thanks very much for chatting today. I had another bunch of questions, which I'm sure I'll get to them eventually. If people do want to ask you questions, they can always go on your website and find details and contact you that way, can't they?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, please have a look at my website, Nikki K Fitness, and also please have a look at the BayZen website, Health for Performance, if you need more information about REDS. But yeah, I'd be very happy to any further questions or suggestions even, you know, for the website, because the BayZen website, I try and keep it up to date. But, you know, any comments on it, like actually, can you put in this article or can you change that, or questions? I'm always open to feedback. So that would be great.
Okay. Excellent. Brilliant. Well, thanks very much for sharing your ideas today with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.